lines he carves in their abdomens. An important thing to remember is that killers who mutilate make up a very small subset of offenders. First off, they're just about always men. Second, most of the men who mutilate do it for utilitarian purposes. They dismember so they can get rid of the body parts and prevent identification. Then you've also got offenders who are offensive mutilators. He's pissed and gets his revenge by attacking the genitalia, the sexual areas of the body. The smallest group of this, already small subset, are the guys who do it because they get some sexual satisfaction out of it. Some wear the vulvas they cut away. Others play with them.
Thanks for that, Hurdle said. I haven't eaten dinner yet.
Honestly, Vale said, for the purposes of catching marks, why he's doing these things to his victims is not as important as our observations. And that brings us back to his sexual orientation being a key to finding him.
Because that's where he'll be finding his new victims? Morrison asked.
Or it could just be a place of safety and comfort for him, where he doesn't think we'd look for him. Before he was arrested, he did not get his victims from gay hangouts, and not all of them were gay. Hurdle took a moment to bring Tarkov and Morrison up to date on their new undercover op involving gay bars.
We were never able to determine how he found his vics, Curtis said, and it wasn't exactly forthcoming about it, or anything else, when we had him in the box.
Let's get back to victim preference, Hurdle said, because that holds a lot of promise for catching him. If we know the victim population, and we can narrow the geography where these people congregate, we can use that to our advantage.
Morrison, get with Walters. That'll be your focus. He turned to Vale.
When do you think you'll have an answer on whether or not this victim is one of ours?
Let's see if we can get an ID. That might help.
If the Vic's gay, would you think it's more likely a Marks kill?
Not necessarily. It could have been opportunistic. Guy stumbles on Marks, who might have been planning to stay in the park overnight, and he has to kill him to keep him quiet.
Or, Morrison said, maybe the Vic and Marks knew each other years ago and this was a retribution kill. Way he's dressed, could be a lawyer. Let's see if the Vic matches one of Marks' defense attorneys.
Whoa, Vale said, holding up two gloved hands. Before we go running in a million directions with a ton of assumptions, let's pull back a second. I think there's a real good chance this was Marks. We've got a general witness description that matches well, and we've got a fugitive killer on the loose in the area. For now, I'd call it ours. But by morning, we should know more definitively. Her phone vibrated. She struggled to get it out with her gloves on, so she pulled one off and answered,
Art, kind of late to...
Got another crime scene. Arson case. Fresh. If you're not busy, thought you'd want to take a look.
Busy? Nah, just sitting around watching mindless reality TV.
Where?
In the sticks. I'll text you the address.
On my way.
She hung up and asked Hurdle if there was anything further he needed her for tonight.
Crime scene one of my colleagues wants me to take a look at. We good here?
Got it covered. Have fun.
Oh, yeah, a blast.
Chapter 30
Vale arrived at the address the GPS directed her to, but aside from a massive emergency responder and law enforcement vehicles, she would have sworn she was in the middle of nowhere. Thick stands of hickory, cottonwood, and hemlock trees obscured the residence from the road, and there were no neighbors for quite a distance in any direction. She pulled up behind the fire marshal's truck and found Art Rooney moments later, walking alongside a man and a woman dressed in fire department uniforms. Rooney excused himself and met her about 20 yards from the burned-out structure. Small flare-ups of fire still visible here and there. Firefighters quashing them as soon as they sprouted.
Is it definitely arson? Vale asked.
Affirmative. I'll show you what we've got so far, but let's not forget that it's below freezing and damp out because of the snow, which makes an accidental fire less likely to do such dramatic damage without some very substantial help.
Same guy?
Hard to say just yet, but my gut says yes. If nothing else, look at a basic fact.
The arsonist we're looking for chooses his targets in rural areas where there's distance between the houses, which means it delays discovery, allowing it to burn longer before the fire department can get to it. More importantly, rural areas are served by volunteer fire departments. Not as experienced? Potentially, but they have to go to the station first to get the trucks, and then they go to the fire. That obviously allows it to burn longer. That extra time means less evidence left behind for investigators to find. Our arsonist has done this in every single instance. That alone is an identifiable MO. But there's more? Yes, Rooney said. There is. Follow me. They walked around the scene and approached the area where the front door had been located. Rooney pulled out his phone and turned on the flashlight. See this? Vail crouched, got close to the spot where Rooney was pointing. Tool marks on the strike plate. In other words, evidence of forced entry. The fire also extended beyond the perimeter of the house in an unnatural manner. Plus, there's extensive damage. There are no V-shaped patterns, and the fire looks to be low-burning. V-shaped patterns. That's when a naturally occurring fire burns up and out, she said, bringing her hands together and separating them as she gestured toward the sky. Correct. Usually the V is burned into furniture and or walls. We checked the light bulbs, too, because they're often a natural point of origin in fires. They'd be melted and flat on one side, like an arrow pointing you to where the heat source was greatest. Again, nothing. So without all that stuff, we've got enough to call it arson, but that's not all. Unusual burn patterns? And high heat stress. Come inside. Rooney led the way into what Vail guessed had been the living room. He knelt again. Know what this is? Sterno can. And that's part of our unsub signature, right? Sternos, a bizarre and inefficient way of starting a fire. But it's not the only thing that's strange. He rose and swung his body and his light 180 degrees. What am I looking at? That, Karen, is ritual behavior for this arsonist. Vail stared at the detritus in front of her, some of which was surprisingly intact. More sterno cans and lids, burned remnants of a wood match, wax, and a small fragment of what looked like a rag. Can you be more specific? Not yet, but generally speaking, this is his way of setting the fire. This is the point of origin. There's some kind of elaborate setup he constructs that gets the fire going using these items you see at your feet. Why go through all that? Think, Karen. Why do any of our offenders do the shit they do? This isn't any different. Vail nodded slowly. None of this is necessary to start a really hot fire that'll kill inhabitants, destroy evidence, and take down the structure. It can be done a lot more efficiently. But for some reason, doing it this way has meaning to this guy. He likes it. Fantasizes about it. Right. I'm not sure how all these pieces fit together, but I'm going to work on it. Go through the prior crime scene videos and photos to see if I can reconstruct what he does and why. A chilled wind blew across the landscape and a shiver racked Vail's body. She stood up and began flexing her fingers. Will you keep me posted on what you find? I'd love to keep expanding my knowledge base, know what to look for in a scene like this. I've got the basics of arson, but, well, there's a lot to know. Rooney rose from his crouch. Soon as I get some more forensics back, you'll be the first to know. Chapter 31. The morning came with one redeeming characteristic. The temperature had risen to 35 degrees. Well, two. It was not snowing. Marks had a third reason to celebrate. He had spent the night in a secluded area in Greenbelt Park, inside a very comfortable Mercedes S-Series sedan, outfitted with plush Napa leather seats and the heater running most of the evening. Before retiring, he had sought out the hot showers described in the brochure and map he had taken from the self-serve receptacle upon entering the grounds. He spent only about 10 minutes under the water, but it was like being home before his incarceration. He could close his eyes and not worry about being shanked in the side. Out in nature, no dim-witted idiots in his space. For the first time in years, he was at total peace. Afterwards, he retired to the car and enjoyed the most restful sleep he had experienced for as long as he could remember. He awoke at first light, feeling refreshed and ready to take on whatever obstacles he would face today. And given what he had planned, there would certainly be some significant challenges. However, he derided himself for not learning his lesson at the barn. He should not have slept so soundly. He should have been on alert for threats that approached the car. But the hot water, fatigue, and constant stress won out over self-preservation, at least for 7 hours. He needed to regain his edge or he was going to get caught. Marks checked around outside. Trees stretched in all directions, some fallen and others canted at 45-degree angles to their brethren. Snow blanketed the landscape as far as he could see. As he sat there, he ran his hands over the supple leather and thought he could get used to this. He could not recall a time when he felt so relaxed. And it was going to end now. He had work to do. He leaned forward and craned his neck, looking left, right, ahead, and behind him. No one was in sight. He took Nathan's DOP kit and used the reflection off the tinted exterior side windows of the sedan to trim up his new beard, which was still mostly black with a touch of gray around the chin. He combed his hair, snipped a few stray strands with the scissors, and made it as presentable as he could. He had gone to sleep while it was still wet, and that never turned out well. However, hidden beneath a wool knit hat, that would not matter. He brushed the trimmings off his clothing and appraised the reflection. Not bad for an escaped felon on the run, but was it good enough? While the sleep did him a world of good, did he look presentable or would he scare away an unsuspecting passerby? He could not be objective, and he did not know what picture the police were using in their wanted notices on TV and online. Probably his booking photo, which was now several years old. Wait, no. They had shot another one when he was transferred to Potter. Nothing he could do about it. Except he popped the trunk release and rummaged through a road hazard toolkit, which contained nothing of use. But he found a National's hat in a backpack, a more disarming look and better coverage than the beanie, along with a sweater and a bottle of sunscreen. He searched inside the car and pulled a pair of aviator sunglasses from the glove box. Not a good look on him, but the idea was to hide his identity, not pose for GQ. With the hat, shades, and nascent facial growth, it was a decent start. He parked the Mercedes up the road several spots from his discarded beard and hair clippings, then wiped down the interior and abandoned the vehicle. Marks made his way on foot toward Kenilworth Avenue and found a Chinese takeout restaurant. After crossing the street, 10 feet from the door, he saw two police cars cruise by. The officers' heads rubbernecking in both directions, looking for him, no doubt. He ducked into the storefront and quickly moved away from the windows. By the time his order of chow mein was ready, the cops were gone, off to another part of their patrol grid. He asked to use the phone and called a cab. 20 minutes later, the taxi was dropping him half a mile from where he really wanted to go. A used car dealership that had been around since he was a teenager. He never bought a car there, but his friend Booker had. When he walked into the office, it was pretty much as he had remembered it, a shithole of a business. The elderly man lounging behind the counter was camped out in a lawn chair watching some insipid TV show on an old compact VCR television propped in a corner on a pile of yellowed phone books. "Help ya?" "Looking for a car, something old, real cheap, got cash." "How much cash you got?" "What's the cheapest car you got?" The man put a beat-up clamshell cell phone down on the counter, swung his feet off an orange overturned bucket, and stood up. Not quite erect, but enough to shuffle his way out the door. Marks realized the guy was older than he had initially thought. "Name's Oliver. You?" "Bud. Friends call me Buddy." "Can see why." He didn't turn, but kept walking another dozen or so yards. "Anyone else work here with you, Oliver?" "Nope, just me. Ain't got no kids, neither. Don't make enough to hire no employees." "Why?" Marks took a look around, trying to appear nonchalant. "Just looking for a job." Can't help you there, son. Oliver stopped in front of a sedan to catch his breath and leaned his right hand on the hood. But I can help you with a car. Got something for $125. Still run? It runs. How much longer? Who knows? How many miles? Lots.
Oliver straightened up a bit and started trudging along again, working his jaw. Then he said,
I take it out every now and then. Engine purrs, runs real smooth. Not burning oil, so that's good.
He stopped in front of an ancient Buick LeSabre, its tan finish long faded into a hazy gray suggestion of its former luster.
64, nothing fancy, gotta roll down the windows with a crank, automatic transmission, but no headrests, none of them airbag doohickeys, no electronics, just your basic car.
Can I take it around the block? Oliver reached over to a carabiner hanging from his pants belt loop and selected one of several dozen keys.
Just around the block, and don't get lost. Police'll track you down if you try to stiff me.
Marks took the ring from Oliver and said, Yes, sir, be back in 5. He returned in 3. It had decent pickup, the engine was in surprisingly good condition, and the tires were not bald. It needed an alignment, but it was a sturdy car, built like they made them back in the 60s.
So?
Marks pulled out some of the cash that Victoria had given him, which he had counted before getting out of the Buick, and made a show of slapping each Andrew Jackson into Oliver's hands.
120 work for you? All I got with me. 120 works. Enjoy your car, buddy.
Marks adjusted the aviator glasses on his nose.
I'm sure I will, Oliver. I'm sure I will.
Chapter 32. Marks settled himself in front of the Cyber Cafe PC. He entered the code the guy at the register had given him and was granted access. He took a moment to look over the desktop, which was a lot more flashy since the last time he had used a computer over 7 years ago. But once he started clicking, he realized that Windows still worked pretty much the same way. There was a start button, and the taskbar contained a big blue E for Internet Explorer. Except that when he launched the program, it said Microsoft Edge with something called Bing. Whatever, it worked, and he was able to get onto the Internet. He first searched for FBI profiler Karen Vail. It brought up dozens of articles and a number of references to her in the form of press releases on the FBI website. There was even one in the search archive related to her work on his case when he was arrested. He found an article in the Post quoting her on how important an arrest this was for Fairfax County Police because Roscoe Lee Marks is the worst of the worst and getting him off the street made the county a whole lot safer. Marks clenched his fist. What bullshit. And how cliched. What the hell do you know? He realized he had said that aloud. A woman, 2 seats over, glanced at him. He shrank a bit in his seat and smiled sheepishly. Sorry. He turned back to the monitor and continued reading. A quote from Eric Curtis, the detective on the case, saying how they could not have captured Marks without the assessment provided by the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit. He paged back and clicked on another link, and another, and another. Vail had been one busy frigging profiler, and successful. If an organized society for serial killers existed, they probably would have taken out a contract on her by now. He searched for the address of the Behavioral Analysis Unit, but could only find FBI Academy Quantico in a couple of press releases. Finally, he discovered an announcement from a local real estate firm touting the contract they had scored in leasing 12,000 square feet in Acquia, Virginia, to the FBI for an expansion of its Behavioral Analysis Unit. Marks grinned. Only this time it was genuine. That was exactly what he had been looking for. He scribbled down the name of the complex, then looked it up and found the address. Bing asked him if he wanted to map it, and he said yes, clicked the link, and it showed him exactly where the building was located. It even gave him an aerial view and an interactive look at the surrounding streets. Very helpful.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bing. With that in his back pocket, he typed in his daughter's name. Could he be so lucky to find some kind of reference as to where she would be hiding? Nope. Articles on her book, that damn book, and a list of signings and speaking events on her tour, but cancellation notices appeared next to all of them. He clicked a link among the Bing results and landed on Jasmine's author webpage. The photo of her was professionally staged and designed to invoke a sense of pity. At least that was what he took from the picture. Most fathers look at images of their daughters and see beauty and innocence, but he was not most fathers. He paged through her website and found the contact the author page. He chose to send her an email. His fingers paused over the keys, rage building as he composed his thoughts. He banged out an angry message, then deleted it. Shorter, simpler, was better. I'm going to make you pay. Yes, that would do. He hit send, then glanced at the clock on the taskbar. He had to finish up. He typed his name into the search field and, whoa, lots of results, including his mugshots and photos he didn't even know were public, pictures of himself he had long since forgotten about. He suddenly became very self-conscious. He leaned closer to the screen, looked left, then right. A patrol car rolled by slowly outside. Marks nonchalantly turned away from the large windows. Several people were in the cafe, all doing their own thing, tapping at their keyboards or reading the monitors, oblivious to the police outside, oblivious to him inside. Marks returned to his task and found a Post article dated yesterday. His gaze moved across the page so fast he realized he was not absorbing the impact of the information. He slowed down and took a deep breath. There was a U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force working his case. They had interviewed officials at Potter, and damn it, they had found Williams' dismembered body and were attributing the murder and subsequent defiling of the corpse to him. His eyes zeroed in on one name, Karen Vale, the thorn in his side, the one apparently as responsible for his incarceration as his goddamn daughter, was noted by an FBI spokesperson to be a key member of the task force who had thus far made invaluable contributions. Marks clenched his jaw. He should have strangled her in the interview room when he had the chance. He shut the browser and paid for his time. Time more than well spent. Chapter 33. Marks drove into the Acquia Commerce Center parking lot, surprised there was no security presence of any kind, not even a guard booth. He had stopped at a crafts store in Alexandria and purchased a pair of fake eyeglasses, which would look less suspicious than shades. While they cut down on glare, few people wore them on a dark, overcast winter day. His first goal was to not get caught, and his second was to avoid anything that would make him stand out in any way, which directly impacted goal number one. Marks chose a parking spot that gave him a view of the front entrance of the building on the left. Its counterpart on the right could easily have been the one in which Vale worked, but he had to start somewhere. If he was lucky, no matter which one she entered, he would still be able to see her. One of his fellow inmates, a more recent addition to Potter, told him about the security cameras that a lot of businesses and government institutions had begun installing in and around their buildings. Because he had seen them at Potter, Marks knew what to look for. He checked when he entered the lot, but only saw a few devices closer to the facility, far enough away from where he was parked that he doubted they could see him. They were a little different and did not exactly look like cameras, but they had a round bulbous covering that was conspicuously out of place and did not seem to perform any other function. He decided to play it safe, and assumed they were the surveillance devices his colleague had warned him about. Because it was winter, and in the midst of a cold spell, he figured that agents and visitors hanging out near where he was parked would not be a concern. In fact, no one lingered after leaving the buildings or the warmth of their cars. That lowered the risk that someone would stand around long enough to notice he was sitting in his vehicle for an extended period of time. 90 minutes passed when a blue, late-model Honda pulled into the lot and parked two rows over, close to the left building's entrance. A redhead got out, and Marks rose to attention. He had to wait for her to turn her head a bit to get a good look. It was Vale. He watched as she walked briskly to the behavioral analysis unit external staircase and then entered the facility. His goal was to follow her when she returned to her car. Sooner or later, she would lead him to Jasmine. Once she did that, he might have the option of killing both of them. Now that would be quite a deal. 2 for 1. And if he did it right, it would not cost him a thing. Chapter 34. Vale headed to her office where she had to drop off a report to Lenka, who planned to distribute copies to Gifford and DiCarlo. Vale could have emailed it, but she had one boss who preferred to do things the old-fashioned way, and one who was not tech-savvy and wanted hard copies with a wet signature whenever possible. She printed off the document and signed it, checked her messages and inbox, FedEx and UPS deliveries, and left the paperwork on Lenka's desk. Karen? Vale turned to see DiCarlo walking toward her. Saved me a call. Where are we on Marks? How close are we to finding him? Doing our thing. I think it's taking longer than the Marshals Service thought, but he's an intelligent offender, and he seems to be a few steps ahead of us. You're not still spending time on Jasmine, are you? Of course not. Haven't seen her since before the officer assigned to protect her was murdered. DiCarlo gestured at Vale's back. Turn around.
Turn around?
What are you wearing?
A knife.
Head of the Joint Terrorism Task Force gave it to me.
I don't care who gave it to you. I care about you carrying it. Only your bureau-issued Glock is authorized.
Here we go.
Actually, Knox authorized it.
Director Knox?
Yes, ma'am.
Now, why the hell would he do that?
Take the easy way out of this, Karen. Be smart.
Probably best if you ask him yourself. Vale backed away down the hall. I've got to get over to the command center. Lenka's got a copy of my report.
With that, she turned and walked briskly toward the exit.
Vale had just slid onto the Honda's cold leather seat when her phone vibrated. It was Curtis.
Got a line on Gaines. Kubiak came clean while a detective Linscombe with the West Virginia State Police was booking him at the county jail. Could be good intel.
Where are you?
About to leave the command center. Meet me there. I'll wait for you.
Curtis was sharing a coffee with Tarkov, Ramos, and Walters when Vale arrived. She walked over and filled her travel mug.
Where's Hurdle?
On his way over, Tarkov said, rolling his chair to the left to give Vale some room. She dumped a packet of sugar in the Java and stirred it.
So, what did Kubiak give us?
Gaines got a house in Lake Ridge.
Lake Ridge, Vale said. You serious?
Not like it sounds, Curtis said. Best we could tell, it's abandoned. Owners nearly went belly up during the housing crunch. They negotiated a deal with the bank and kept the place, but the wife has cancer, so they're living with one of their kids in Ohio while she gets treatment at the Cleveland Clinic's cancer center. House has been empty for about 11 months.
He's squatting in a vacant house? Vale asked.
Free rent. Nice place. What could be bad?
She moved over to the computer by the side wall and sat down. We have an aerial?
Ramos worked the keyboard and brought up a satellite image.
What do we know about Gaines? She asked as she studied the screen.
Tarkov pulled his handgun from a locked drawer and holstered it.
Not exactly a model citizen. Did 3 years for assault when he was 21. Some drug-related offenses in 07. Charges dropped. A couple of drunken disorderlies. Another assault. Charges dropped again. Picked up for soliciting. Paid a fine. And a dumb vio 18 months ago, he said, referring to a domestic violence complaint.
What are you thinking? Curtis asked.
Vale pulled her gaze away from the monitor. Just that we don't know what to expect. We're only going there to do a knock and talk, sit him down, see if he'll answer some questions, but...
The door to the command center opened, and Hurdle and Morrison entered.
Vale looked again at the satellite imagery.
It's a big house. I think we should all go. Gives us numbers without overkill.
Talk about overkill, Walter said. You're just going to question the guy about Marx, not something he himself's done wrong.
Marx could be there.
Walter squinted.
Not likely. We've got an undercover sitting on his house. Gaines is there. No sign of Marx.
How long has our guy been there? Tarkov checked his watch.
About 90 minutes.
Do I have to state the obvious? Vale turned to Hurdle. He could have gotten there before our undercover set up shop.
Hurdle bent over the countertop and peered at the screen, examining the bird's-eye view of the neighborhood.
This cul-de-sac off Wainscott? What's the problem?
Vale put the lid on her coffee mug and leaned back against the wall of the RV.
We need more men than just me and Curtis. Even if we're confident Marx isn't there, it's a big house in a heavily wooded area. Gaines could easily slip out the back. He gets away, we may never find him.
You think he's going to try to run? Hurdle pulled his gaze away from the computer.
Why?
Gut instinct, Vale said. Really depends on whether or not he's involved with Marx. But even if he's not, this is a guy who's had some run-ins with law enforcement. He's living in a house that doesn't belong to him. He sees us coming?
Yeah.
I think his predisposition is going to be to take off. He's not going to hang around to answer questions.
I'm with Vale, Ramos said.
Hurdle mulled that over, then said,
Okay, the seven of us go. We'll treat him like a hostile.
Walters glanced over at the screen.
Any firearms-related offenses?
Nothing in the system. Tarkov shrugged. Doesn't mean much if you ask me.
I agree, Hurdle said. Wear your vests.
They took two cars, and half an hour later they were sitting at the mouth of the cul-de-sac, a few houses away from Gaines' location.
Nice homes, Morrison said. 3,000 or 4,000 square feet, probably half a mil apiece. Maybe they've got another vacant place nearby.
He saw Vale's look and gave her a half grin.
Just saying. Wouldn't mind spending a weekend or a month or two here.
Vale removed her Glock and got out of the vehicle, joining Hurdle at the front bumper of his sedan.
How about you and Walters deploy around back while I go up and knock?
Woman, less threatening.
Curtis and Rambo can take up positions by those trees about 10 and 15 yards from the door.
Morrison and Tarkov can take the sides of the house in case he jumps out one of the first floor windows.
I like it. Hurdle nodded at the men.
You heard Vale. Let's do it.
They moved into place swiftly, using the cover of bushes and thick tree trunks. As Vale approached the front lawn of the colonial-style home, a car horn began honking.
What the hell?
Vale swiveled and tried to locate the vehicle.
This is deliberate. A spotter, watching out for Gaines, warning him someone was approaching the house.
She was sure everyone heard the signal and realized what was happening. Before she could turn to make eye contact with Curtis and Ramos, gunshots burst through the front door. Vale dove to the grass, nearly dropping her Glock. Seconds later, the assault stopped.
You okay?
Hurdle asked over the radio. As Vale and Curtis ran a zigzag route toward the front of the house, Vale keyed her mic.
We're fine.
But the homeowners are not going to be happy when they get back to Virginia and find their house shot to hell.
This is just great, Curtis said. He's obviously not coming out, and we can't go in.
Ramos positioned himself on the opposite side of the doorway behind a large planter.
Why the hell not?
No reason to. This is now a barricade situation.
Vale stood up and pressed her back against a pillar on the wood deck.
We should have SWAT deal with this.
Good call, Curtis said. Can't argue with that.
I can argue with that, Ramos said, as he peeked over the planter to get a better look.
There's no exigency, Vale said. No reason to go in. No one in harm's way. He's not even threatening to kill himself.
I'm calling it in, making the request, Curtis said as he drew his radio.
The three of them heard the reply. SWAT was 17 minutes out. Vale texted the rest of the team, who also heard SWAT's ETA and requested a sit-rep situation report from each of them.
Seconds later, their responses came through. The rear of the house took gunfire as well. The sides were quiet.
Second gunman in there with Gaines? Marks? Or was Gaines just standing in the middle of the residence and firing in both directions?
We need to go in, Ramos said.
Were you not listening? Curtis asked.
Booker Gaines, Vail yelled through the door. This is the police. SWAT is en route. Throw down your weapon and come out with your hands on your head. We just want to talk.
Well, now I want to kick you in the nuts, but officially, we just want to talk.
Go away, or I'll kill everyone in here.
Vail and Curtis exchanged a look. Vail keyed her radio. Hurdle, you hear that?
I did.
Curtis elbowed her. You got him to talk once. Keep the dialogue going.
We certainly don't want that, Booker. Can I call you Booker?
Gaines' answer was decisive, more ear-shattering gunfire, then silence.
Guess that would be a no.
Ramos moved beside Vail and keyed the radio.
Boss, this guy ain't coming out, and he may have hostages. We need to go in.
Hurdle, back at them over the two-way.
Give it a minute. Everyone hold your position.
At the 60-second mark, Hurdle's voice crackled over the speaker. Vail lowered the volume.
We have zero confirmation he's got anyone in there. We're going to wait and let SWAT handle it. They're making good time. Updated ETA, 9 minutes.
Let's use the time to our advantage, Vail said. Rambo, you're with me.
With you where?
We're going to do a quick canvas. Maybe a neighbor's seen Marks or someone else in there. We need to know if Gaines's really got hostages.
Come on,
she said as she started a strategic retreat from the property. In truth, she wanted to take his mind off Gaines, let him cool down, and get him away from the house. As they made their way along the sidewalk, Vail glanced over her shoulder at the street behind them, checking for the lookout. If he was still there, who had honked a warning to Gaines when they arrived? She saw only two cars, and both appeared unoccupied.
Curtis, she said into her radio, head over to those vehicles parked at the curb. I don't think there's anyone in them, but be careful.
She explained what she was looking for and why.
I'll ping you right back if I find anything.
Vail thanked him and continued on to the two-story to the east. No one answered, but at the residence to the west, an attorney who worked out of his home office and who had to be persuaded to come to the door in view of the automatic gunfire said he thought he had seen another man enter the residence.
When was this? Vail asked.
He glanced past Vail and Ramos nervously.
You sure it's safe to stand here?
The gunman's inside the house, Ramos said. And we've got it surrounded. If you'd just answer the question, sir.
A few days ago, maybe Wednesday.
How old was this guy? Ramos asked. He shrugged both shoulders as he thought.
20 at most. A teen, maybe. I'm not even 100% sure it was that house. I think it was.
Any other activity? Vail asked. People going in or out? Cars or trucks that don't belong?
I've been tied up with a case I'm litigating. I haven't really paid that much attention.
You know that your neighbor's been out of town? Ramos asked.
I only moved here 5 months ago. I haven't had time to go door-to-door meeting people.
He made a show of checking his watch. If you don't mind, I've got a conference call in 5 minutes, assuming the shooting doesn't start up again.
For all our sakes, I hope that's the case.
And do us a favor, stay inside until we get the situation under control.
He gave a nervous laugh. You don't have to ask twice.
They thanked him and started back toward the house, just as SWAT arrived. The armored Bearcat, it looked like a cross between a tank and a truck, pulled in front. Hurdle and Vail used the vehicle as a shield as they briefed the commander, whose uniform tag read, Morales.
We did our best to put together a breach plan on the way using Google Earth images and what we could pull up on county records for the house's blueprints. What can you give us on the occupant?
Suspect's a squatter, Vail said. Owners have been out of town for several months.
Far as we know, Hurdle said. There's no one else inside.
Check that,
Ramos waved a thumb over his right shoulder. Neighbor back there saw a young male enter a few days ago.
He thinks he saw, Vail said.
So there could be two occupants, Morales said. A hostage?
Potentially.
Suspect said he had people in there and was going to kill them, but it could have just been bullshit to keep us from going in.
Morales absorbed that, then said,
What do we know about your guy?
Buster Gaines, Vail said. He's got a sheet. In and out of trouble with the law, domestic violence, drugs, assaults, nothing over the top. His buddy's the fugitive serial killer Roscoe Lee Marks, so it's possible Marks is also inside.
An officer emerged from the SWAT vehicle with a K-9, who was outfitted in a black tactical vest, leading the way.
That's Rex, Morella said. Belgian Malinois.
SEAL Team 6 used one of those on the Bin Laden raid, Hurdle said, as he and Curtis joined them behind the Bearcat.
Affirmative,
Morales glanced around at the cul-de-sac. Other than that one neighbor you talked with, have you done a canvas?
Only had time to hit a couple houses, Vail said. The rest of us were holding our positions, all entrances and exits.
You guys going to breach? Curtis asked, or are we looking at a barricade?
Morales chewed his bottom lip.
You think he's a talker? A negotiator?
Ramos laughed.
No, sir. Definitely not.
Tried that, Vail said. He answered with a burst of automatic rounds.
Okay. He may have a young male in there. He's shown extremely violent tendencies, and he's volatile.
I think we've got exigency. Better to assume that's the case than do a time-talk-tactics approach and have a hostage get killed.
Time-talk-tactics? Curtis asked.
Methodical approach. We try to negotiate by phone, bullhorn, throw phones, anything that'll get them to communicate with us. If that doesn't work, we shift to annoyance tactics. Breaching windows, shutting off utilities, deploying flashbangs to get his attention, and eventually tear gas to try and drive him out.
We might even get a robot in there to get eyes on or send Rex in. All else fails, our team goes in. Very time-consuming. Could be an all-day or more affair.
We've got Marks out there, Hurdle said. We can't afford to dick around with this guy.
I've got other considerations, Morales said, but I understand the pressure you're under. He gave the structure a once-over.
Gaines is not the homeowner, so I doubt he has authority to deny us access. We're going in. I'll deal with the consequences, if there are any.
He then turned and conferred with his mission leader, a younger man with a crew cut. Morales brought the radio to his lips and issued orders to the other 10 officers, who had already taken up their positions.
Can we follow you in? Ramos asked.
Morales gave Ramos a look that bled disbelief.
No.
Hurdle checked his watch. How long?
I know you guys want to get in there ASAP. We'll do our best, but you gotta understand it's a slow, systematic process.
As Morales moved off, Ramos frowned and said something to Hurdle. Vail did not hear it, but she picked up Hurdle's response.
It was the right call, Rambo. If we knew for sure there's a hostage in there, we would have gone in. But he's got a semi-auto, and we have no good reason to enter.
Seven of us, and one of him, Rambo said. That's all I'm saying. We could have handled this.
I can do the math. Let it go.
Hurdle kept his focus on the SWAT team as it deployed. Take a breath and stay on your toes.
Vail watched as Morales did a knock and notice. He banged on the door, announced who they were, and that they were going to enter. Almost immediately, an officer released a couple of flashbangs on either side of the house. The mini-explosions were concussive, designed to induce fear and overwhelm the occupant, lead him to believe that an army was about to storm the place. And that was not far from the truth, because in the next instant, a breach specialist swung his battering ram and blasted the front door in. They tossed in a gas canister and entered. A few minutes later, Curtis came up alongside Vail.
I don't hear anything.
You won't.
They're looking for a barricaded suspect, so they're not going to be shouting to one another as they clear rooms like we do. Everything's done with low whispers and hand signals. That way they can also pick up any movement from the suspect or hostage. Sometimes when they enter a room, they cover the angles and hold for several minutes in silence, listening for movement.
Curtis eyed her. How do you know so much about it?
I'm part of a black ops team.
Read an article.
She checked her watch and waited. It was going to be a while before they could get their hands on Gaines.
Ramos, Curtis, and Vale entered first, followed by Hurdle, Walters, Morrison, and Tarkov. Hundreds of brass shell casings littered the granite floor, and the smell of munitions hung in the air.
Where is our suspect? Hurdle asked.
Morales shifted his MP5 to the left across his shoulder.
No one was in the house.
No one? Vale swung her gaze around the main floor.
We had the entrances and exits covered. How the hell did he get out?
Follow me. Morales led Vale, Curtis, and Hurdle down to a finished basement. A large open room with sports loungers and a 60-inch LED television with surround speakers mounted on the ceiling and walls.
Got his assault rifle, though.
He left it behind? Curtis asked.
Found it down here, Morales said as his tactical boots gripped the tile floor. When we breached the door, he needed to get out fast. As soon as you see what I'm about to show you, you'll understand.
They moved left past a pool table and stopped at a closed door. Morales pushed it open and they filed in.
Laundry? Hurdle said.
What gave it away? Washing machine or the dryer?
Vale walked in farther and examined the long and narrow area, which seemed to run at least half the length of the house. Above her were two windows. One of them was unlocked.
You saying he went out through here? We had guys on both sides of the exterior.
First clue was that we found the rifle right where you're standing. Second clue was, well, take a look.
She climbed up onto the washing machine and peered into the yard. Stands of pine, hemlock, cedar, and cypress stared back at her, a melting layer of snow blanketing its floor. It's like a frigging forest back here.
What am I missing?
Over here, Morales moved several feet deeper into the room. I think the unlocked window was a ruse, or it could have been accidentally left like this by the homeowner, and Gaines had nothing to do with it.
He pulled open a cabinet door and gestured them over. I was referring to this.
Rex sniffed it out.
Vale jumped down off the appliance, turned on her phone's flashlight, and peered in.
Gaines made a tunnel? Are you kidding me?
Wish I were. I've only seen this twice before in all my years with SWAT.
Vale stuck her head in. Where does it lead?
Go in, take a look.
Vale snorted as she drew back.
No thanks. I don't get along well with tight spaces.
And this is one time when I can say no.
I'll go, Curtis said as he turned on his iPhone light and climbed in. I've got to see this.
He got in about 5 feet before he backed out.
Okay, I've seen enough. Nothing elaborate and barely enough room to fit a body. Tell ya, if I wasn't claustrophobic before, this could definitely make me catch it.
It's not a contagious disease, Vale said.
Whatever. I'm not going all the way through.
No need, Morales said. One of our guys took off all his gear and went in. There are some wood planks to shore up the walls. Comes out just past the property line, 12 feet northwest in the dense trees.
That's why he didn't take the rifle with him, hard enough to get a body through.
Hurdle crouched down and took a look for himself.
He really built a tunnel?
He's been here for... who knows, several months, Curtis said, dusting off his hands.
Maybe he got bored.
Hurdle shook his head.
Think like a criminal, Curtis. He must have known Mark's escape plans, and he dug the tunnel because Mark's was planning to spend some time here. We come knocking, he'd have an escape route.
Probably took him, what, a few days, a week, to clear 12 feet of dirt?
Curtis said, but he'd need help, someone to haul off the buckets of soil as he went.
Could have been Scott McFarlane, Vale said. Morales turned and headed out of the laundry room.
Bottom line,
Your guy or guys are gone.
I can do the math as well as Rambo, 7 against 1 or 2, and we still lost.
So, no hostages.
Doubt it, Morales said. But with the tunnel, hard to know. Forensics may help you on that one. Meantime, we're casting a wide net. See if we can prevent Gaines from leaving the area. I've got more men on the way. They'll be here in 5 or 6 minutes. Police are mobilized, too, but I'm not hopeful. Acres of densely wooded land, lots of residences, a park.
Vale looked out the windows and saw the boots and legs of SWAT officers searching the woods.
A school. I saw one nearby, on the aerial view. They need to go into lockdown.
Morales stopped and pulled his two-way and chattered into it, passing on Vale's suggestion. She heard someone descending the basement steps and saw Ramos approaching, followed by Tarkov and Morrison. As Curtis filled them in, Vale turned to Hurdle.
We blew this about as badly as it could be blown.
He glanced around, taking in the laundry room and Gaines's escape route.
Self-recrimination's not going to help us catch this knucklehead.
Yeah, had we known he was going to come at us with guns blazing, we would have done things a little differently. But given what we knew, he was not an extreme threat, and there's no way in hell we'd think he built a tunnel. It didn't work out the way we wanted, but I don't think we blew it.
Sometimes shit happens. Way I see it, no one got killed. On our team, or innocents in the area. Only bad thing in all of this is that one of our prime witnesses is not in our custody answering our questions.
Vale put her phone away. Then I suggest we turn our attention to getting a warrant and tossing this place. See what we can learn about Gaines and Marks and their relationship. Maybe we'll get lucky and find a cell phone he left behind with Marks's number in it.
Don't count on it, Curtis said. Too goddamn easy.
Plain sight stuff, Hurdle said to everyone. We need something that'll give us probable cause for a warrant.
They fanned out, all of them but Vale and Curtis heading back upstairs. Vale shoved the Samsung in her pocket, pulled on a pair of gloves, and wandered around the room. There was not much in plain sight, so she made her way over to the living area, the entertainment cabinet and loungers, while Curtis checked out a nearby walk-in closet. She noticed something wedged into the side of the recliner, a DVD case with a handwritten note in Sharpie marker.
7YO.
Vale bent her head and read the spine from a different angle. 7-year-old? She pushed down hard on the leather seat, and the cushion parted from the armrest, revealing part of the DVD's cover.
Got something?
Curtis joined her just as she held up the disc.
Are you shitting me? Child porn?
A photo of a naked boy had been inserted inside the clear plastic sleeve of the case. She pulled it open and found a burned DVD marked in the same black handwriting. Jimmy.
Yo, Hurdle,
Vale called out. A few seconds later, he came halfway down the steps.
We've got our probable cause. Not exactly what we were looking for, but it'll do.
Given Curtis's first-hand knowledge of the scene and police department procedure, he drove back to Fairfax to video conference with the magistrate. If all went smoothly, he would have the warrant in hand in about an hour.
Makes me want to vomit.
Hurdle tossed the disc onto the recliner.
At least it'll get us the warrant. Good job.
I'm afraid to see what else we'll find. This cabinet could be filled with more of that shit.
She sat down on the lounger and thought for a moment.
Can I ask you something?
You're asking me permission to ask me a question?
No. Yes.
She glanced around and saw that they were alone.
I want to know what's up with Rambo. I mean, you know him pretty well, I take it.
Hurdle pulled out a pack of gum and folded a stick into his mouth.
How do you mean?
Kind of chomping at the bit.
His time in Iraq, urban warfare, changes you, your outlook. Asked him about it once, he said, you can't be afraid to go after the baddies or you shouldn't be carrying a badge. Risk is part of the job.
I'm okay with smart risk. even desperate risk, but not foolish risk.
Every circumstance is different. You never did something that in the moment seemed like it had to be done, but in retrospect was a foolish risk?
Let me count the times.
Hurdle did not wait for a reply, or he read Vale's face and got his answer.
I guess one man's smart is another man's foolish.
Not sure I agree with that.
I take Rambo for what he is, a good cop, a solid task force member. He just needs some policing at times.
He headed toward the stairs. I'm gonna get up there and finish looking around.
Vale checked her watch, then called Jasmine to see if she remembered anything about Gaines, whether or not she might have an idea as to where he would go, places he used to hang out. She doubted Jasmine could offer anything of value, but it was a logical question to ask. The call went to voicemail, and Vale left a message.
Maybe she turned the ringer down while she was in a movie and forgot to fix the volume.
As she sat down to clear her mind and think, Walters and Tarkov joined her with reports of what they had seen in the bedrooms, most of which seemed to pertain to the homeowners. However, it did appear that two beds had been slept in recently. They would need a more thorough evaluation with forensics to know for sure.
Hurdle followed moments later with his assessment of the caliber and type of weapon Gaines had used. Based on the spray pattern and shell casings, it looked to him to be 40 caliber rounds from a semi-automatic weapon.
Not very helpful. We pretty much knew that when we were under attack, but I think there's evidence of two shooters, one of whom only had a handgun. We really need to wait for crime scene and their analysis. And no sign of that teen the neighbor told you about.
Could be we were right before, Vale said, about finding Scott McFarlane. Just a guess, but it's an educated one. That group seems to have been together since middle school, if not before. No reason to think McFarlane was an aberration, and it would explain why we haven't been able to find him.
By the time they finished their discussion, Curtis texted her that the warrant was approved. They all returned to their floors, and Vale began by rummaging through the basement closet, picking up where Curtis left off. It doubled as a second pantry and storage room. She saw winter clothes, ski equipment, and other assorted items a family stuffs into available spaces. Vale saved the entertainment center for last, partly out of avoidance. She already knew what she was going to find. When Curtis returned with the warrant, she briefed him on what he missed, including the potential second occupant in the house. She then moved on to the cabinet beneath the television. They were full of old DVDs and tapes of family videos from the last 20 years or so.
Well, that was a pleasant surprise.
Until she opened another drawer. Here we go. More DVDs. And not the G or PG rated kind. Except... Curtis crossed the room and knelt beside her. Gay porn? They looked at each other. Wonder if Gaines... Was he Mark's lover?
Interesting question. Or McFarlane, if it was him who was shacked out here with them. Let's keep looking.
Vale returned to her area and found sex videos with handwritten labels. She put one into the DVD player and fired up the TV.
Oh, shit, Curtis said. More child porn.
Vale wanted to turn away but could not. She needed to see who was in the video, specifically which adults, if they revealed themselves to the camera.
There's Gaines, right?
Curtis, his eyes narrowed as if to lessen the impact of what he was viewing, tilted his head. Vale hit rewind on the remote, got the spot she wanted, and hit pause.
Only got a portion of his face in the frame.
The lab can do a better job with this, but I'd say maybe, maybe not. Don't know. Could be him.
Based on what she was seeing, she thought again about that teen the neighbor mentioned, but the age was not right. These were not young men. They were boys.
When's crime scene due here?
They're here. Started on the main floor. He held up one of the DVDs with a gloved hand. If it is him in these videos or some of them, we've got him dead to rights.
Either way... Vale said, doing her best to keep the bile from rising in her throat.
Really wish we had this bastard in custody.
We'll get him, Curtis said, averting his eyes from the screen.
Turn that shit off. We'll let the guys at the lab analyze it, see if we can get some other faces and IDs. Maybe we'll get lucky and get McFarlane in it, too.
Hopefully, they can pull some metadata off the DVDs that can tell us where they were made, shut them down. Vale returned the disc to its holder and pulled out her radio, told Hurdle what they had found.
I'd like to get some agents in the Cleveland FBI field office over to the house where these homeowners are staying, break the news to them about their property and unwelcome guest. Leave out the part about him shooting up their place, but we need to cover all the bases and ask if the husband had a secret collection of child porn and if he's gay.
Hurdle snickered. That's gonna be a fun conversation.
Got a better idea. Have them arrange for a Skype session when they get there. I want to see their reaction. No, I want to interview the husband away from the wife. If this is his shit, he won't admit it in front of her.
Will he admit it even in private? It's a federal offense.
I'm not expecting a verbal admission. That's why I want Skype. I need to see his reaction.
I'll have someone arrange it. Over.
Vale continued looking through the collection. Assuming this stuff belonged to Gaines, I can see why the asshole ran. Might have nothing to do with Marks. You got anything over there?
Male porn, bondage stuff, nothing like what you found.
Curtis tossed a stack of magazines to the ground.
Like you said, maybe this is just noise.
If we catch Gaines, this isn't noise, Curtis. It's leverage.
Chapter 35. Mark sat in his 64 Buick, windows closed, and the Nat's hat pulled down low over his forehead. With the sunglasses and beard, he hardly looked like himself, which was the point, of course. Once the car he had been following turned into the Lake Ridge neighborhood, he knew where Vale and company were headed. It allowed him to drop back and keep a discreet distance. Unfortunately, because he no longer had a cell phone, he could not warn Booker and Scott, who was on the way to their place. So he did the next best thing. Blaring his horn from over a block away would be heard, but he could not be seen because of the trees and the curved angle of the streets. There was no way for him to know for sure, but he was reasonably certain that they had gotten the message. He moved farther down the road and parked on a side street while waiting for Vale to leave, assuming his buddies did not kill her. But when the SWAT truck rumbled past him, his shoulder muscles tensed and his level of apprehension clicked up several notches. Almost 4 hours later, Vale and a couple of other cops drove by, headed away from Booker's house. Though he wanted to double back and check on his friends, were they in body bags or had they gotten away, he started up the Buick and followed Vale's vehicle, keeping as far back as he could without losing her. Thus far, she seemed to have no idea she was being shadowed, which was exactly what he hoped. It was nearly 8 p.m. when Vale pulled into the driveway of a residential neighborhood. Marks coasted down the street, several car lengths behind her, and came to a stop against a curb, idling, observing. He killed the engine and sat there, wondering what his next move would be, what it should be. One thing was certain, however. He was building his book of intelligence, and now he had a key piece of information, one with potential leverage. He knew where Karen Vale lived.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.